When fire gutted Eugene's beloved Civic Stadium last year, a group of adolescent boys turned out to be responsible. They were burning trash in the old wooden grandstands when things took a turn for the spectacularly destructive. At the time, three of the boys were 12 and one was 10. Adults far and wide wanted to know, what on earth were you boys thinking? But our guest today says decision-making in adolescence really is a whole different ballgame, and that a more responsive line of questioning might be, what on earth were you boys feeling? She's a psychologist and the principal investigator for the Laboratory of Adolescent Science at Vassar College. Dr. Abigail Baird is a guest on a recent edition of National Geographic's Brain Games. It's a new TV show airing Sundays at 6 p.m. on the National Geographic channel. And she's our guest today here on The Exchange. Dr. Abigail Baird, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, Abigail, when do teens become adults?
That's a great question, and one that I'm sure many parents would like a firm answer to. Unfortunately, it varies a great deal, and it varies not only by individual, but by culture. And in American culture, it can take quite a while. There are some outside estimates that a lot of teens don't fully mature into adulthood until 24 or 25 years of age.
And so how, you're a psychologist, you're also familiar with developmental neuroscience. For you,
yes,
how do you chart the rise of mature decision-making in a brain, you know, from a chemical standpoint?
It's a great question. Our lab doesn't study the chemistry so much as the structure and function of brains. And so one of the things that you can look at is the way that the connections in the brain change over time in the same individuals, but also the way that, activity is processed. So, for example, there are certain decisions, like the one you described in the intro of you know, burning some trash or starting a fire for fun.
Uh-huh.
That in a wooden grandstand.
Right.
That if I asked most adults about, you wouldn't actually think about it. You'd have this kind of gut feeling of, oh God, no. And what we kind of miss is when we ask young teens those same kinds of questions, they don't have a gut response. They actually really do have a cognitive, a very labored, thoughtful process about whether that's smart or not. Why that is, my lab suspects, is because they don't have enough life experience yet. They really haven't had enough experience with things to have that quick automatic gut or emotional feeling of, oh, no, no, no. So instead, they actually have to reason it through. And again, since they're young and their reasoning is not what it will be in another, you know, 5 or 6 years, they don't always get it right.
So does this gut feeling have a home in our brain where you're, say, looking at a brain scan of adults versus teens when they're making decisions, and what you're calling the gut is a particular part?
Great question. It does. In fact, it's something called the insula, and it's buried kind of deep. If you could push your fingers through your ears, which I would not recommend, but if you could, that's about where it's located, down deep in the covering of the brain, but kind of folded inside. And it's the same part of your brain that gets very, very active, believe it or not, during food poisoning. If you've experienced food poisoning, those memories that remain that make it hard to eat something that you've been poisoned by, it's exactly the same part of your brain that then helps us avoid very intense social mishaps. Maybe guilt, for example, makes us feel absolutely nauseous and sick in the same way that bad food does, which is an extremely adaptive thing to have, but it takes a while to acquire.
Now, at your laboratory for adolescent science, when you're looking at, say, an adult's response or an adult's process for making a decision versus a teenager, when that gut reaction kicks in for an adult, do they have to have prior experience with, say, arson to know that it's a bad idea?
Not necessarily. So what's fascinating about it is even one of the things that happens when your frontal system and your cognitive system becomes increasingly mature, one of the benefits of that is you can start to abstract. You can really start to put yourself in other people's shoes. So as you mature, your direct experiences that are similar to those, so, you know, most people by the time they're in their late teens have had some experience with heat or fire or something related, maybe not something directly similar, but related enough that when they hear stories, the adults around them can, with the right emotion, express, oh, God, that was very, so much like the time, you know, and then relay a very emotionally laden story. That shared emotion, that storytelling, can often teach the brain, once you're a little bit older, can teach the brain in the same way that actual experience can. But when you're very young, you really only learn through your own experience. I mean, imagine trying to convince a six-year-old not to do something by telling them a very complicated story about your own adult experience. That wouldn't work.
Uh-huh. We're talking today with...
No.
Yeah, right. Or, you know, telling them that will burn you, don't touch it, and they don't seem to believe you until they feel the heat.
Exactly.
We're talking with Dr. Abigail Baird today. I'm Emily Cureton. You can join this discussion. Dr. Baird is a professor of psychology at Vassar College and the principal investigator of the Laboratory for Adolescent Science. No, it doesn't mean immature scientific inquiry. They study the developmental neuroscience of teenagers. If you've got a teen brain on your hands or you have questions about how they work, please join this discussion. Our phone number is 800-838-3760, or you can email us jx@jeffnet.org. Now, Dr. Baird, so teenagers, when they get in trouble, we often ask them, like, what were you thinking? What's going on with you? And how would it get a different kind of response if we asked them what they were feeling?
I think that's a great question. Honestly, I advise parents not to ask them what they were feeling because they'll look at you even more strangely than they already do.
Uh-huh.
I think in terms of interacting with adolescents, the "what were you thinking" phrase is the right phrase to use. But I think in terms of understanding what's actually happening, the flaw, if you will, and it's not necessarily a flaw, but what gets them into trouble is that they think too much about things that as adults we would never even think about. So one of the things that I do recommend parents do when they're concerned about the way that their teens make decisions is help them visualize the outcome. So literally, have them narrate their experience and kind of walk through it. One of the examples that I often use is sort of, you know, leaving a high school dance, and everyone knows not to get into a car with someone who's been drinking. So you ask your teen that, and they say, yeah, I know that. And then you say, okay, well, what door do you think you're going to leave the dance from? Oh, I don't know. Okay, well, I want you to picture it in your mind. Picture in your mind and tell me, which door do you think you're going to leave from? I don't know. Okay, well, think about it. And so you can actually try to teach them to kind of walk through and mentalize, imagine the actual experience, which is what they usually get stuck. That's where they usually get stuck. They can't actually see the stadium catching on fire in their head. So walking them through literally what could happen and having them to describe it to you is probably one of the ways that you could support good decision making.
Interesting. So let's do a hypothetical here. Say we have a gaggle of eighth grade girls in a room, and we ask them, do you guys think swimming with sharks is a good idea or a bad idea? What are we likely to find out from these girls?
Well, two things. And they're both, it's funny because they're both addressed in Sunday night's episode on National Geographic. The first piece I'm going to tell you is covered by me. The second piece is covered by a second scientist. The first piece is that they won't say no immediately. They'll consider all the kind of different scenarios. Now that's a pretty straightforward question, but you'll hear younger kids start to throw in all kinds of qualifiers that weren't part of your question. So if you ask them about the safety of swimming with sharks, all of a sudden they'll say things like, well, if I had a friend with me, it might be okay, or not all sharks will hurt you, or they really think deeply about this and explore all the possible scenarios, which is wonderful and healthy and totally safe if you have adults looking out for you. And that's the kind of thinking we want young brains to do. But honestly, when you watch it as an adult, your mouth falls open. You're like, wait, so the question was, should you swim with sharks? It's a very straightforward question. But to younger people who are protected, they should have a chance to kind of make some mistakes that aren't lethal. Now, sharks generally are a lethal proposition, but not always. The second piece that would be really important is something you said, a room full of girls. So peer influence becomes a huge factor during adolescence. And it's not always bad. It's an adaptive thing. We learn the most from our peers during adolescence, and usually we learn good lessons about what's cool and what's not cool and how to be an adult and all the stuff that's helpful. But we also tend to get into trouble with our peers because they're not always the most experienced people. And so, you know, also see a scenario on Saturday Night Show where teenagers do a great job driving until they have a bunch of other teenagers cheering them on. And that really kind of distracts their ability to focus and make good decisions.
Let's take a call, Dr. Baird. We've got Jake in Springfield on the line. Jake, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. You're on the air.
About the stadium being burned down in the heat of summer in August,
uh-huh.
I knew it was probably a juvenile, and I knew that it was male. You know, it wasn't going to be little girls. And so I wanted to point out that even bigger than being young for crime is being male. I mean, men commit over 90% of all property crime, over 99% of all sex crime, over 95% of all violent crime. And maybe if you're going to get teens a pass, maybe we study male brains and say, hey, men should get a pass too, because the male brain's just, you know, more crime prone compared to women, and we should be in prison at a 50% rate compared to women if we want an equal society.
All right, Jake. Thanks for those thoughts. I'm not sure anybody here is suggesting we give teens a pass on bad behavior. Dr. Baird, you have worked a lot on the intersection of this science and law. You want to take it from there?
Yes, absolutely. So the caller makes a very good point that there is absolutely the numbers are different when it comes to crime. But the behavior is actually not. What gets lost in translation there is that because of social pressures, because of the way that as a society we treat young boys and girls, boys do tend to be a bit more impulsive, but what's radically different is that boys are socialized to externalize their behavior and girls are socialized to internalize their behavior. So for every boy who destroys property, you have a girl who has an eating disorder or is cutting herself or is depressed. Girls hurt themselves, boys hurt others. As a sweeping generalization, there are lots of contradictions to that. So I don't think letting anyone off of the pass, meaning, you know, if you see a girl who's struggling with eating, you don't simply say, oh, well, that's just part of being a girl. You get her treatment. You know, if you see a boy who's acting out more than most boys, you don't give them a pass. You get them some help.
And so your work, you've contributed to the amicus briefs that helped the U.S. Supreme Court abolish the death penalty for juveniles and more recently abolish life sentences without the possibility of parole for juveniles. Can you tell us more about that and some of the more extreme cases of transgression by teens?
Yes, actually, thank you for asking about that, because it's something I feel very passionately about. I think one of the grave mistakes we've made is in sort of perpetuating this myth of the adolescent super predator. And this myth that adolescents are more violent than adults. And in fact, violence among adolescents has steadily declined. Media coverage of it is up, I think, 400% in the last couple of years. I'd have to double check that, get the most recent number. But we sensationalize adolescent violence. And it's honestly, it's been on a steady decline. That's one piece. The second piece that I think is critically important to understand is that the juvenile justice system was founded on the idea of rehabilitation. It was created and based on the idea that adolescents aren't done. And when they commit a crime, there's no crime that makes you mature. If anything, it indicates the opposite. So to put in a juvenile into the adult system and treat them as an adult because they've done something wrong just doesn't make any logical sense. There's no way that people in this country would agree to be tried by a jury of 15-year-olds. There's no way. If you said, you know, I'm bringing you in, you've been charged with a crime, and by the way, your jury is a group of 15-year-old girls.
Right.
People would lose their minds. They'd, no, you can't do that to me. Those people aren't adults. They can't make a reasonable decision. But if someone's 15, they've done something violent, we have no problem saying, well, they should be treated like an adult. So I think there's a fundamental hypocrisy in that. And again, it goes against everything that juvenile law is based on, which is this idea that rehabilitation is possible when you're younger.
And is that rehabilitation impossible when you're older, or is that out of your scope there?
It's a little out of my scope, but it honestly is a lot less likely. And unfortunately, you know, there are so many flaws in our prison system, and you know, I would hesitate to speak too much to the prison system because there are people who could educate you far better than myself. But I do know, especially when it comes to younger people, you know, one of the reasons that we have an adolescence is to learn how to navigate our culture. So if you spend a lot of time in prison when you're young, that becomes your culture. So you actually understand that better than the actual world, and you crave that more than the actual world. So one of the problems we have with prison is that it teaches people how to survive in prison. It doesn't teach people how to survive outside of prison. So from from where I sit in the science world, you're training up brains to be very good at being in prison. And that actually doesn't really help solve the problem.
And we're getting some comments coming in here really focused on the gender disparity, both in the crimes that are committed and in the behavior of teenage boys versus teenage girls. You mentioned earlier girls tend to internalize things. They hurt themselves in a lot of instances. Boys are more likely to externalize and perhaps hurt others. Do you study the brain chemistry of boys and girls, or have you studied it separately to see, is there any difference in the neurological processes, or do these processes just kind of take a different form once they're out in the world?
Yeah, and again, I mean, it comes down, there's definitely chemistry involved, but also the way structures function, and again, the way all of this behaves in response to the environment. There's wonderfully elegant work that's been done. I'm thinking particularly of Jay Gee's work at the NIH. He's done a fantastic job showing us how differences in adolescent hormones, particularly estrogen and testosterone, triggered growth in different areas of the brain at different times. So one of the things that you will kind of consistently find being very different between boys and girls in early puberty is impulsivity, that boys get a bigger rush of dopamine during their adolescence. And dopamine is a chemical in the brain that makes you feel reward, but more importantly, makes you feel anticipation of reward. So a lot of adolescent boys get a really big sense of get up and go, really interested in trying novel things, really interested in taking risk. And this perpetuates our species. It's a great thing to have if you want to be brave and find new territory and learn new things. Girls, in their boost in estrogen, boosts a lot of other things, including a hormone called oxytocin, which facilitates relationships and facilitates emotional memory, which is why any female will tell you once another female crosses you, it's very, very difficult to forgive her, because our memories, our emotional memories, are so intense and so good. And there are structures in the brain that in each sex temporarily become larger during adolescence, and then again, by the time everyone's in their late 20s, there's more difference within sex than between sexes. Adolescence is just a peak time when the sexes are divergent.
We're talking with Dr. Abigail Baird, Associate Professor of Psychology at Vassar College and an investigator of adolescent science there. She's also featured on National Geographic Channel's Brain Games. Time for another call or two here at 800-838-3760 or email us jx@jeffnet.org. I'm Emily Curitan. I've got a comment here from a listener who did not leave their name on this vein. They said, testosterone makes it so boys don't get as much oxygen to the brain. I believe boys should be chemically castrated for violent crimes. Yeah, so how does that make you feel, Dr. Baird?
Oh, well, first of all, I'm not going to repeat that to my 7-year-old son or my 7-year-old daughter. I have twins. That honestly, I'm sorry, but that's just silly. No, absolutely not. The things that make boys adventurous are some of the things that make those individuals great. And not every boy is adventurous, and they shouldn't be shamed if they're not. There are a lot of boys that actually are introverted or are anxious and are not as adventurous. That's fine. No, there is nothing. You look across cultures, and it's not the case that every single male is aggressive inherently.
Right.
They have to be given permission. They have to be encouraged. The same kind of get up and go that can make a person aggressive can also make them pro-socially aggressive. I mean, think about the men and women. It was mostly men, but men and women who ran into the Twin Towers when they were collapsing. That's the same kind of get up and go that gets people in trouble, but it's extremely pro-social. Without people who are willing to run into burning buildings or to put their lives on the line for us, a lot of us would die. So I really can't get behind that comment. It's not always a negative thing. It can be used for great good.
Well, good to know what is out there. Could you tell us more about your view of adolescence as a type of second toddlerhood?
Yeah. I do think it's a little bit glossed over, because there are a lot of times when once people hit the teen years, a lot of parents go, oh, phew, I'm done. They made it.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I actually think there's just as much parenting and adult presence needed during especially the early adolescent years, as it is needed in toddlerhood. The same systems get an overhaul. So in toddlerhood, you know, you learn to speak your native language. when you become a teenager, you learn slang. You know, if I were to use some of my adolescent slang, you would quickly realize that I grew up in Boston in the 80s.
Uh-huh.
And you also learn how to think abstractly. So toddlerhood, the terrible twos is when toddlers start to say no to things because they realize that's an option. They realize they can say no. Teenagers, for the first time, realize, I might be able to get away with this because I can plan out a scenario that's different. So their abstract reasoning also changes. A lot of the same brain systems go through a similar overhaul. There are two periods in your life when your brain grows really, really quickly, toddlerhood and adolescence. And they're both to get you ready for the next big stage. Adolescence is your last chance to grow up before you become an adult. So a lot has to happen. It has to happen quickly.
And you mentioned slang in there. Why does slang matter? Do adults need to speak teen slang?
No, great question. We actually need to really not. So if you, as a 40-something, are fluent in text, you need a hobby because those are not your people, and they're not going to enter your mating pool, hopefully. And, you know, the slang is a way that we are chronologically and geographically locked to our own mating group forever. Slang should change. It should be contextual. Parents of teenagers should know a little bit. Like, you should know enough to maybe, you know, like, we all know LOL or, you know, very simple things like that. But the intricacies of what's popular in regional slang, no, adults don't need to know that. Teenagers do because they need it to communicate with each other. And it's designed to keep other people out. It's designed to be a coded language that helps them find each other.
And does it change, you know, as you get older, you drop your slang because you don't need the coded language anymore?
Exactly. Unless you're someone like me who, you know, I meet up with my brothers for a couple of years, and within 5 minutes, I'm calling them my brothers because we grew up in Boston. All of a sudden, you know, you have a couple of beers and talking about old times. Our accents come out. We start using slang we've never used. So it's a way to reconnect and reminisce. But as adults in a larger society.
Dr. Baird, with just a second left here, I'm curious, why do you study teenagers?
I love them.
I love them.
I think they are often maligned in a way that if you take a closer look, almost everything they do makes sense. It's just a matter of seeing it from their perspective and then helping them get where they want to go.
All right, A Change in Perspective with Dr. Abigail Baird. She's an associate professor of psychology at Vassar, a principal investigator of the Laboratory for Adolescent Science, and featured on the National Geographic Channel's program Brain Games. You can check it out, find all the details online at jeffexchange.org. Thanks so much for being here, Dr. Baird.
Thank you for having me. Wonderful questions.